G.K. Chesterton, who was a UK writer in the turn of the 20th century, one of the quotes I love from him says, it's not that they don't understand the solution, they have no idea what the problem is.
Welcome to Illuminate Higher Education, sponsored by End-to-End Services and our Illuminate app. Join us each week to hear from industry leaders, technology leaders in higher education, and most importantly, students, to chat on hot topics, share solutions, collaborate, and envision the future of higher education together. Let's illuminate higher education once and for all. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Illuminate Higher Education Podcast. I am your host, Kiran Kuritala. I have with us a friend, a fellow technology leader, and also fellow higher education leader. His name is Kevin Pashuk. Kevin is incredible in that he has a career of over 20 years of technology leadership in a number of challenging positions. And it gives him a unique perspective on delivering technology services in complex environments, from startups to large manufacturing, telecommunication, and educational institutions. But even though his background is in technology, his craft is not information technology, but building IT organizations that support challenging and new ways to do things. And that's why I'm extremely excited about Kevin being on this podcast. Kevin has led teams ranging from small group of magic makers in a new initiative, I would like to hear all about that, to a unionized environment of over 100 full-time and part-time employees. He thrives in big challenges that give big rewards, from startup organizations to existing firms that need to undergo a major strategic change. So the thing that excites me most about this conversation is that Kevin writes, speaks, and blogs regularly about his life as a technology leader in the educational sector. His writings cover education technology, IT leadership, and whatever else, which I'm excited about as well, might be on his mind. Some people even agree with him. Kevin, welcome to Illuminate Higher Education Podcast.
Kiran, thank you. Thank you for having me. I truly, truly appreciate it. I think I alluded to you that if you know anything about those of us in the 98th percentile of introversion, when we start talking about the things that excite us, you can't shut us up. So
that's right.
Consider yourself warned.
That's great. Well, that's exactly the type of personality we want on this call. People who are extremely passionate about what they do. And it looks like you are passionate about a lot of different things. And when I look at your bio, you've worked at startup companies, you worked in telecommunication sector, you worked in education sector. And every time I meet somebody like that, I get excited because there are some good things about each of these sectors and also things that are much wanted, especially around the educational area. As a journeyman in this career as IT and leadership, what are some of the things that you are seeing are good things about education and also things that can be improved upon?
You know, education as a sector is probably one of the least transformed of all the sectors that are out there. We don't travel the same way. Well, we certainly don't travel the same way in the last year, but the travel sector, banking sector, so many other things. I can go on. Should I need a cable for my computer, I can have one the next day without, you know, getting up out of the comfort of my chair. Even during COVID, the ability to go around and find that one restaurant that's open now, you can all do that from your phone. You know, my 90-year-old mother can stay in contact with people and get blocked on Facebook for what she says. I tell her, they don't know you're 90, Mom. But you go back to the educational sector, and man alive, in the University of Boulogne, there is a lecture hall, and it's about 600 years old. And with the addition of a projector, it's still in use today, which means we haven't, many of the methods used to deliver what we do in education have not changed much. We have applied technology, and there's some great pockets of excellence and islands of wonderful. But as an institution or collectively as a sector, we have not transformed very, very much. I'll talk about it later and some of the disruptors that were coming our way well before COVID. We're really poised for a phenomenal disruption there.
taking a step back, right?
Sure.
The thing that's interests me is that even institutions, when you look at educational institutions, they are major research institutions, right? They are creating the new version of internet. They are creating a new version of email. Yeah. Some of these universities are at the forefront of building the next smartphone. And obviously, they're inventing other things like medicines and others as well. But they're, you know, to use the metaphor, they don't use their own dog food, right? If you think about it, they are inventing a lot of things in the research area. But when it comes to administration, institutions are using a completely different methodology where it feels like research and administration are using a completely different approach. Are you seeing the same thing in the institutions you worked at, or is it more native to the United States?
No, I think you find that across the board. Now, for those listeners who don't have the advantage of video, that's probably a good thing with my face. But you can tell by my vintage, Karen, that I've been around the block a little bit. and I've had a son that attended one of the premier universities in Canada, you know, well known for its research and such. And the system to register him and get access to information he needed to be a successful student was dismal, if I could say that. The disconnect between what we are doing to transform industry outside of the sector,
right,
and what we're doing internally at the sector. And I've worked in medical education, you know, which involves the worst of every government and medicine and academia. I've worked at, you know, in supporting universities. I worked in other industries. But typically, here's my little story about that, or because when you have so much to deal with, you tend to simplify things. The metaphor I tend to use on this one is, if you go back to the medieval feudal system and picture this, where you have a whole series of lords with their army, and they'll, you know, call them the faculties and the research departments, and you have the king, which may be the president of the university,
has no
power and no budget, and anything centralized. You know, so to get anything done, the king has to go out, or queen has to go out and find a common enemy, and then convince the lords to get their armies and rally them around to achieve this thing. The power and the politics in that is phenomenal, but it's never done for the good of the whole. It's typically done to achieve kind of a very singular one-off. So here we are, and I'm in an institution. We call ourselves an institution, and this is the piece we're changing, but you know, we don't act like an institution. We don't budget like an institution. We don't plan like an institution. We don't execute projects like an institution. The very, very basic things that would inherently tie together and unify consistency across the board. Go to London, England, at the base of Tower Bridge. There's a Starbucks there, and I can order a tall bowl and get a tall bowl at that Starbucks in London, England, because when I can go back to traveling. Go to one department in my school and go to another department, and the CRM system they're using may be a whole completely different piece, or it might be something they invented themselves, or we're still using spreadsheets. Thank you very much. We use language of unity, but we're not working in some of the very basic 101 stuff. This is the non-sexy foundational pieces. They're the ERP systems, they're data governance. It's searching high and wide, far and wide in this sector, for good examples of data governance. I can find lots of examples of universities and colleges in their institutional research department. And so they departmentalize, they put it in a silo, and they've got policies around there. Very difficult to find one that goes and transcends the whole institution.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, because it feels like what you're saying is there are silos, and the silos can be business process silos, technology silos, legacy silos, and that is preventing institutions from being uber efficient, if you will, right? Is that what you're thinking?
Absolutely, yes. You know, the thing we did wrong is we put human beings in charge.
That's right.
And I say that because, you know, human beings are phenomenal in their ability to do marvelous things, but they're also really, really good at creating bureaucracy and obfuscation and very difficult, complex ways to go about doing something simple. We have a meeting, 40 people show up. Do 40 people need to be at a meeting? can we possibly talk something to death? You know, one of the medical schools I was in, it was a brand new startup. It literally started with a piece of paper, a paragraph. I was handed a two-sided piece of paper. And it had a paragraph on it that said, a day in the life of a student, a day in the life of a faculty member, a day in the life of a researcher. So go build this. It was literally, and I'm not making this up, this is primarily what it was. We had 2 years before students were walking in the door, the first cohort were walking through the door, to build a medical school built on a distributed education model. So as you can probably see, we were a little busy. We had a lot to do, so we could prioritize. I mean, I remember going to conferences and listening to presentations, and I'm going, my goodness, that is like one element on my whole project chart, you know. Choose a learning management system, you know, boom, gone, done, you know, away we go. But even in there, with that level of intensity and that kind of focus in terms of delivery, I had a young fellow, I couldn't make the meeting, so I said, you go in and take notes. And the young man was literally fresh out of co-op term, and he was starting his first real full-time job. So you can tell, a little wet behind the ears. Great kid. He's now a manager in that school. But came back from the meeting, how'd it go, Steve? He goes, well, they took 20 minutes to determine whether to call it a coffee break or a refreshment break, because some people do not drink coffee. And I looked at him and I go, you know, considering all that we had to go and do, I said, whatever you do, Steve, don't become like that when you grow up, you know? But I keep seeing so many examples of that. And even this morning, I was in a conversation where people in the meeting, you know, were hung up on this idea that moving things forward, everybody needs their say, everybody needs to approve, this management by consensus is crippling and hobbling our ability to be nimble and agile. You know, talk about the disruptions coming towards higher education, you know, if I continue to do that as an IT leader, I am going to relegate my institution to obscurity.
Yeah, that's the genesis of this podcast too. In a lot of ways, I feel like we talk about higher education as being stuck in the past, and there are some systemic reasons why that is. There are some regulatory reasons why that is. And there are some, you know, like you're describing, political reasons. So this brings me to the question about your personal journey. You worked in startups, you worked in healthcare, you worked in telecom. What made you work at higher education? Was it an accident? Was it something that you felt like this was your calling? Can you talk to me a little bit about your personal journey, Kevin?
Sure. Again, prairie philosopher warning you, it takes me a while to get to the point. So put up with my
That's
story.
That's fine. We have the full 45 minutes.
You know, I'm talking generally here too. So when I make statements, they're not specifically about my employer. If my employer is listening to this, therefore it's important that these are my observation over time. So, you know, there's so many things that impact our where we end up. And you know, in the days when I flew a lot and traveled for work, being an introvert, we don't like talking small talk a lot. So I learned the art of the interview. And you're doing a very good job of it, by the way, where you get people to talk about their favorite subject. And the question I usually used was, did you pick your career or did your career pick you?
That's a loaded question, I'm sure.
Well, and it's fascinating who I've met and their stories. So I've kind of approached it from that, you know, so some of the things were my choice and sometimes, you know, I was channeled into it. So I was the kid that I had a 1 hour lunch break in my school and a 10 minute walk home. So typically that should work out. The math should work out. I get home in time for a sandwich. It took me 30 minutes to walk a 10-minute walk because there are too many things to see on the way. You know, there's a puddle. There is a bird. There's, you know, practically anything. I would be just distracted because fascinated with discovery, fascinated with learning things. You know, that is just my wired, my makeup. But let's just say I was a terrible student. The system was really designed for quiet little people that could learn the correct answers, not ask too many questions. You know, if you like discovery, you really didn't get that as much as you were given. Here's what the next thing on the plate. At least that was my experience going out, you know, not to denigrate things like memorization and using our brain and such, but if that's all you get, that doesn't feed the way that I learned well, you know, so I couldn't get myself out of school quick enough. You know, as soon as I could get out of high school, I did. Now, interestingly enough, I, you know, made my way all the way through a master's degree, but I got to a level where it was a type of master's degree where I did it through a university that was fully online. So while I was traveling, working, instead of watching TV at night, I was doing my studies and it was directly applicable to what I was doing at the time, which is supporting medical education. So, you know, I got all the way to there. But it was a long journey for me. And boy, did I get some scars and calluses along the way. And the irony of me ending up in education, you know, considering how much I disliked my experience, is there. But I'm probably the kind of person you want in the mix.
Yeah.
To really recognize that it is not a uniform experience for all people. You know, and our understanding of the world has opened up so much more in turning. I'm seeing a trend, and we can jump into this later, of you know, international students versus domestic students, and then figuring that international students are a great source of income, but not really understanding that there's a really unique culture that comes along with that. And you just can't take the domestic culture and overlay it on top of an international student and hope for success. But look at where we're sending our graduates. Let's look at the world that we're putting them out into. I've listened to other podcasts in your series, and you do reference the fact that people are going out there with a degree or diploma and no jobs or no real skills that come with that. But
that's right.
Later on, what's quite often forgotten in that is the significant debt that these kids and these young people come out with.
Yeah.
A degree, a debt, and no job. You know, words just escape me, and I might say something you can't put in your podcast. The fact that we're doing that societally, and we've built a system where you need that piece of paper just to apply for a job. I don't know, Kieran, what you took in school. You know, I started my undergrad in forestry.
Yeah.
You know, how many people are in the field of study that they went to university for? How many people matured and grew through? So you're sitting there going, that 4 years and out model is not preparing for what they're going. If you look at, like, you know, at reading that, you know, Microsoft, Apple, Google, others like Shopify, you don't need your piece of paper to apply for the job anymore. They have figured out how to assess competency. They can tell whether, Kieran, you're qualified to actually apply for that job without a piece of paper that might be 20 years old in a completely different field. You know, those institutions that use a degree or diploma and that's their product,
right?
They're going to be like the buggy whip manufacturers of the early 20th century. Today, there's some valid because so many HR systems, that's their first gate before you can even apply for a job. You know, mm-hmm. and the small to medium enterprise market is not cut up to the bigger organizations that have figured out this concept of assessment. But, you know, my prediction, you're going to see like third party groups that are really going to work and like jump in and partner with somebody coming out of high school, regardless of where they happen to be in the world, and begin to say, what's your academic journey? Let's learn about you. And here's some pathways you can go. It sounds a lot like a video game. I know that, you know, I get these skills, these worlds open up to me. I get more skills. I don't go away for 4 years and come back to the game. I go pick up a bag out of a box. You know, this stuff throws me off. Suddenly I can now do these quests, or I have these powers. And now that is so in some twisted way, easily applicable to the student journey. Like I'm seeing that there's probably going to be a third party that brokers the mm-hmm. student journey, but uses data and AI, you know, in ways that schools could never get their act together to do, to really understand this individual. I mean, Amazon sucks a lot of money out of my wallet, and I'm holding it open for them because they understand me better than sometimes I understand myself. You know, they almost got me one day. Kevin, we think you need a new camera. And I almost help her. But think about this, as you as a student in your academic journey, that if you had that concept of counselor that was independent and you talk about the field of things like micro-credentials, well, who certifies this micro-credential? Is there one institution? Me, I work at Sheridan College. Do we say that we've got, you know, come here and your transcript, everything in your worldwide experience, the transcript comes from our institution?
Mm-hmm. No.
It just logistically can't do that. But you begin to say, well, what is the certifying and regulating body that is going to gather these and collect these? You're probably looking at somebody who's brokering this, like Amazon does for resellers and vendors. You know, so you begin to start looking at what are we giving? What are the things that truly impact us? Now, in technology and the support of technology, part of what I'm doing and the initiative I've got underway at my school is called Rethinking IT. Something very simple that people can understand, which is moving away from the traditional IT department, even silos within that traditional IT department, silos within the faculties and silos within marketing and the registrar's office, and moving into, if we were designing an IT services organization, would we be structured the same way? And the short answer is no. Could we stand alone and deliver what the school needs to do. And so that's been the transformation since I got back to this school 3 years ago. We've got to do that in order to get things nimble and agile. We're still working on some incredibly boring stuff in the governance, you know, even our enterprise system. You know, you say move to the cloud. Well, what if all your data, nobody knows where it is, and it's collected in various spreadsheets and small databases, and you got four CRM systems, depending on which department thought they had a good idea, who went to the last trade show and bought a CRM system. Core things like systems of record. How do you know that that student's address is that? How does your data work with the data of the rest of the world? Like if that student wants to, like if we move forward and say that, okay, well, there's not one institution that can have all of my credentials. How do I gather that quickly together? Is my university or my college ready to play in that world?
Yeah.
But I'm working on the prep work at our.
This is amazing. I like the fact that you're able to take your life journey about, you know, in your own mind, you called yourself a terrible student. But I think the issue is not that you're a terrible student. You're just a, let's just take a step back, right? I think we're talking about how education is built right now and why it's built. If you think about our modern education system, it's all built on administrative convenience. You know, it's the right way to teach a student how to learn is to look at every student and look at their individual growth on this learning pathway and say, okay, this student is at advanced calculus in math and, I don't know, Shakespeare poetry in English and whatever, like biology, he's reading human anatomy. Each of student is considered as a unique individual with their own unique lifestyle, unique learning style, and unique background. Well, you know, if you tell that to any administrator, they're like, well, there's no way we can do that. You know, yeah. We don't have time for that. We don't have money for that. So we'll just put them in cohorts and say, we'll put them in the first grade cohort, second grade cohort, freshman cohort, junior cohort, sophomore cohort, like cows in a cow pen, if you will, right? To be blunt about it, we are treating humans as each person purely based on their age is exactly the same.
Yes.
We're ignoring their social background, economic background, every single fabric of their, you know, growth and learning styles and putting that in there. So I think that's a fundamental issue. So then to make things worse, they'll say, well, you know, we put them in this cohort. We need to figure out if they can move forward or not. And that's why we have this concept of standardized tests and say, you know, okay, you got an SAT grade, SAT score, well, you're good or bad.
Karen, so, I don't know if you've seen the little cartoon that floats around, and it's a guy sitting at the desk saying that, and for the final exam, all of you go climb a tree and there's an elephant and a monkey and a bird and you know. And
yeah.
Now we're moving into the world where certain sectors have figured out how to use all of these data to actually create that learning experience. And I say there's pockets of excellence and wonderful. In University of New South Wales, Dr. David Kellerman has demonstrated where he's taken this really the off-the-shelf Microsoft tool suite and created a personalized learning experience for 1,000 first-year engineering students.
Yeah.
Brilliantly.
You That's know, awesome.
So it actually tailors their notes and their experience and their delivery and their assessment, you know, in the formative, summative assessments side of life, got even that figured out where he's leveraging the technology to achieve an outcome. And this is some of the things we're really missing here is we're so hung up, you know, I'm speaking generally, and again, you're going to find me 10 examples of people that don't do this, but
sure.
We get so hung up on the way we've always done things. To kind of say, I know that made sense 5 years ago and it was exactly the right thing to do, but what is the right answer today? You know, ultimately, we have to validate. We have to verify. No, we can't have people do that. The hoops we make people jump through, you know, administratively, you know, I figure they should take every senior person in university or college and make them apply for a course.
Yeah.
You know, blind apply for a course like a student.
Right. So that they can see how the student has to go through to get what he or she needs. You're right.
Like standing in line to make an appointment to come back and to have an appointment with somebody, you know?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Simple thing. So, I mean, when I say that we're back a couple decades in the things we need to do in order to become that really nimble 21st century, 2020, take that over and be the leader. It's really a simple exercise. And imagine, if you will, the two-axis chart. And we do this a lot as consultants. On the horizontal axis, what you want to put there is differentiating on one side and non-differentiating on the And on the vertical axis, you put at the top mission critical and non-mission critical at the bottom. So map out what are the things we're doing. And let's just start with the IT services, because that's the field that people, you can do this across the board, but what are the things we are currently doing today that are mission critical but do not differentiate us? Email is a classic example. We need email to be working. We need it working simply. Nobody's going to decide to come to our institution because we have email. So do those things in that quadrant are done as simply as effectively as possible. We don't generate our own electricity. Why would we do these things? Can we get that? Because this is where you're going to find the resources to put the energy, because you don't have time now because you're busy doing all those things, into the quadrant that says these are mission critical and but do differentiate us. These are the things. These are the, you know, really focusing around the student experience and the student's interaction with the institution, our use of data, you know, our ability to move our data around, the data-driven decisions and the analytics. You know,
sure.
So segmented now, we can't even leverage those kind of things. Then we have that quadrant that says non-mission critical, non-differentiating, and I can bet you a nickel, a Canadian nickel, that some of these people listening are going to have stuff in that quadrant. Stop doing them. Why are you even doing them? They don't differentiate to you. They're not mission critical. Yeah. You're spending resources and time and energy. The other quadrant, things that could differentiate you are differentiating today, but they're not mission critical. That's where you put your research in. That's where you start looking at where does AI, where do these trends, where do these things that are coming out, what's working in other sectors? You know, what can we do around the, call it the user experience thinking that is so prevalent in other sectors that is not so prevalent in our sector when it comes to research universities? I mean, as part of medical research universities, you know, nasty little secret, that is where the revenues are. The people who come and pay tuition are funding that activity for the most part. You know, as working and supporting administrators on that side, they feel like they get nothing to help the basic student experience. But if they're a 4-year and out, or, you know, and then for 2 more years or 3 more years for a master's and then a PhD, that's, now there's Ivy League and there's certain institutions that have really built their brand and really built a good experience, and they're going to do okay. Mm-hmm. But hundreds, if not thousands of the other types of institutions that are not there have got to really look at what they're doing.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. I think looking at, you know, each institution, each department has to look at what is mission critical, what is strategic, what is tactical, and make decisions to make sure that their mission is met. And I think your prescription is really sound. And I like how you are using your personal journey to extend your career path and also build education forward. Yeah. But I also like the fact that you are uniquely interesting in that you're not just a technologist, like most technology people are, you know, in your words, like technologists and introverts, and some people call them geeks or whatever, but you're a writer. So you have an incredibly creative side that you talked about as you were on your walk back home from school. I feel like that is part of your experience that's even more exciting for me. I feel like I've been learning philosophy myself, but I've been going in a much more linear direction. Yeah. I started all the way from, you know, Socrates, Plato, and recently I've been doing a lot of reading on Nietzsche. But you are a prairie philosopher. I've heard prairie philosopher from a Native American book. There's a book I saw, but I think your understanding of prairie, your implementation of prairie philosopher is something different. So I would like to hear your, you know, writer part of you, the creative part of you, philosopher part of you, and then we'll back into how that enables your work at Sheridan College.
I got the moniker prairie philosopher from a writer friend who, you know, because I usually take a long time to get to the point, and then, but I do eventually get around it. But I'm telling a lot of stories.
You get lost in the prairies. Is that the way? Is
yeah, it the moniker? And I think I said that if you put a map in the dead center of North America, it's very flat, and it's primarily, you know, cattle and farms, and you know, and lots of space between, big sky, but you know, no mountains or hills to get in the way of anything much there. But the people who grew up there really, you know, the history of the between those who were first there and those who settled in, you know, the 1800s, it was a hard life, hard winters, hot summer, you know. So they tended to be very matter of fact, but with a really incredible developed sense of humor and pretty self-effacing in the sense. You know, what they've really done is they don't think too mightily of themselves, you know. You know, if you ever get to think yourself, you know, somebody, just try ordering somebody else's dog around. It's stuff like that.
Right. Or sometimes your own dog.
You know? Yeah, try, like, it's just like, you know, or stick your hand in a bucket of water and pull it out and see what kind of impression you really leave, you know. little snippets like that.
It's hard to think like that, right? Because a lot of people think that, oh, I'm going to build my legacy by building this big mansion or putting my name on a student auditorium and everybody will remember me after I die. What people don't realize is death is final. Like, who cares whether they remember you or not?
Yeah, I have a photo that I took in the Vatican Museum, and it's all of these busts of, at the time, very famous and influential people that nobody has any clue who they are today. So where's their legacy? You know, so what, like, our legacy at that time, and this is getting down to some of my personal beliefs, which is the legacy I leave is the relationships I build and what I do that helps other people to see their potential. I call them the magic makers. If you met these people, they would look incredibly ordinary to you, maybe even a little nuts. And that's okay. I lovingly call my team my group of lovable misfits, the pretense that we go, and sometimes professionally, we have to put on, you've got to think I'm smart, you've got to think I'm rich, you've got to think I'm good looking. I didn't get good looking and I didn't get rich. So maybe I'll try on the smart thing. But what do you think of my smartness is not as much as what you're going to remember when you meet me. Like what sure. I said is less important than how you feel. That using stories with, you know, in prairie philosophy, I mean, story is, you know, time immemorial, whether it's prairies of North America or you pick a place in the world, the use of stories has been there to actually move culture along, to expect the behaviors, all of these pieces. The people that really understood themselves, which is, I'm not here to try and show you how good I am, but who also most importantly understood who they were talking to.
That's right.
I wrote for a lot of technical magazines for years and who just said, can we write it at a grade 8 level? This is a technical magazine. Why do you do that? Because then you choose your words so that you can actually, you know, the point of communication is that you understand what I'm trying to convey to you.
That's right.
Not
so it's simple. You know,
yeah. And we've got to take those philosophies. I did not experience that in my academic journey. Mm-hmm. Even at master's level, I really found, so who are their favorite authors? Let me make sure I cite them in my papers. And guess what? My marks decided to climb. Am I manipulating them? I wrote a blog post about, am I smarter than my, you know, a psychopath? The story is will influence people, and we all are influencers that. But at the end of the day, where I derive a tremendous amount of joy is seeing people take on and do things that pull it off. The small group of magic makers, it just very quickly, we went into the academic heads of the school I was at and said, without using the word computer or technology, can you describe an successful academic experience? Uh-huh. They went away, this group of people came back in 2 weeks later, and they literally filled a room of whiteboards up with literacies, competencies, modalities, you know, how we're going to measure, where we know, where it needs to happen, all of these pieces. This is understanding learning. We then brought in somebody on the team that quite often when you hear of ed tech, it's either a teacher who likes to play with gadgets or it's a technology person who thinks they can teach. But sure. We brought in somebody who understood the process of learning, how people learn, how do you measure it? You know, so who is an expert in the process of learning, brought them into the IT development stage. We had pictures of these whiteboards of literacies, modalities, and competencies. We went and said, well, a tool that could do much of that is Microsoft OneNote. You know, it gave the flexibility. But if I shared my OneNote file with you, you got to see everything in it. So as an educator who had 30 students sure. in their class, you don't just share everything. You know, that was not good. So they figured out, this smart group of people, small group, figured out how to blow up the OneNote file and create, when we generate the class schedule, there's a tab for the teacher, a tab for every student. Student sees only their tab and the teacher's public tab. Teacher sees everything, zero setup time for the teacher. we took that and we reached out to Microsoft Research because we weren't a software development house. We had developers, but, and we said, are you interested? And I've got a couple of things. One in my file is a note to Steve Ballmer, who was president of Microsoft at the time, saying, I know you're going to, what they were looking to retire OneNote, but we think we have a way we can own the K-12 market here. We gave it to that. That became Microsoft Class Notebook, which was the genesis for Microsoft Teams, which I'm sure your folks have heard about.
Here. Sure, of course. I use some of my customers use it.
10 feet outside my door was two of the most ordinary people you've ever seen in your life that cracked the nut to how to make that happen. And we're using Teams, which happened to be something that I'm not taking credit for Teams by any stretch of the imagination, but because every good idea is built upon something else and the network
sure.
you bring into play. You know, I know I've got a really good story out of this, you know, and it's
yeah.
know, completely true about what happens when you empower people.
Right.
And look what Teams and Zoom has done for our ability to actually not have COVID be a complete and utter disaster for us in our sector.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, backing up into the Prairie Philosopher, yeah. and I like the way you talked about like anecdotes or fables being monikers, right? For example, if you think about how we only started writing or the press only became real around, I don't know, 2,000 years ago, right? But if you look at Homer's Iliad, or in India, there's a Mahabharata, they yeah. talked one of the fables of India, Ramayana, and then a few other fables in Greek and Roman literature as well, they were carried over word of mouth for thousands of years. Wow. How did they survive this long? The reason they did that is because of the whole concept of storytelling, right? You can't expect somebody to remember stats for more than 30 minutes, right? I mean, you can put in all the stats you want, but you can tell a story and the story will carry on, not just generations, probably centuries. And I think we have proven that beyond, but for some reason, you know, as you speak about it, for some reason, when we are technologists or scientists, we focus so much on like making it complicated, making it facts-based, making it numbers-based. We forget that the most important concept of a story is the story itself. And I think it looks like you've considered that in the Prairie Philosopher, but let me just finish that thought there, because sure. if you think about, you talked about Microsoft a lot, yeah. but if you look at Bill Gates' original presentations or Bill Gates' presentations in general and Steve Jobs' presentations, mm-hmm. you know, they are truly a use case in what to do and what not to do, right? Gates is all about numbers, stats, you know, facts, science, and, you know, Jobs basically puts a black screen in the back and maybe a flower and starts from there. And that's it. There's nothing else because he perfects the art of storytelling.
Yes.
And it looks like your Prairie Philosopher concept is really powerful. Did I summarize it correctly?
You really did, you know, and with a couple of caveats. One of them is, you know, years ago, I remember the plant manager where I worked, every morning would get a report on his desk, a stack of printout, computer print. Remember the computer printout, the tractor printout?
Yeah, the laser printer.
Literally probably 6 inches thick of all the production numbers of the night before. And there was two bookmarks in there. And he would flip it open, look at that number, and flip it open, look at that number. Now, that was the earliest version of a dashboard that you've ever seen in your life. But all he needed was those two numbers. But he needed to know that the rest of that paper stack was there in case he had a question, and then he could
add it up to that.
When we tell our story, we have to be dealing in true, we have to be dealing in fact, and we need that binder of material or those huge database to back up what we're saying. We don't need to give them the whole nine yards when we're telling the story, though.
And that's for some people, they don't even need the background information. But I feel like
that gets into the credibility of the storyteller.
Sure.
You know, we've talked a lot about students, but this is also a technique internally that I'm using with my administrative colleagues and my IT team. And they will remember the core concept. What is really important? What are our initiatives? What are our goals? Put them in a story and they're going to remember them a whole lot better.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's a takeaway for me as a CEO as well, because a lot of times I feel like sometimes in my company, I try to explain what we want to do and sometimes even give the justification, but I should do a better job trying to be more of a storyteller. And I don't know how to implement that. And, you know, going back to my Indian upbringing, there was a story book called Panchatantra, which was all about moral sciences, about, you know, how to be friend, how to deal with friends, enemies, stuff like that, similar to, you know, Christian fables, I'm sure. But I still remember some of those stories because they were stories, right? Mm-hmm. If somebody says, always tell the truth every day for the rest of my life, I will not remember it. But I remember then that monkey told a lie and, yeah. I don't know, killed his friend or something.
It's a phenomenal, powerful thing. And, you know, one of the things that I do with my team to help them IT be known within the institution is I'll invite leaders from the other areas, the deans. And we call it the Dreamer Series. And we ask the speaker to say, could you describe and tell us, you know, in your words, if everything was working just as how you wanted it to be, what would it look like? Describe walking through that. What you're seeing, that exercise there for them, it's new for them because people right. love their PowerPoints. They love their charts. You know, I put my hand up and say, can you get one with geezer font? Because I can't read all those words on there. But, you know, look at the people who tell stories well. Their visuals are there to support their words. They create a link, and there's a great book out there called Moonwalking with Einstein. And that talks about the guy that went and signed up for the American Memory Championships, and he actually won it that year. But he talked about all the techniques for memorizing things. But when we look at our brain and how we file things and put things away, short-term, mm-hmm. long-term, because he brings a lot of the brain's studies out, stories anchor themselves. They provide that anchor point you just do not do with facts and figures. It's a tool. It really is probably right. the most used tool in my toolkit.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah. I'm also fascinated by your story. Obviously, it's truth about how your, you know, enterprising and innovative approach of trying to identify how to make classrooms be more helpful, right, by using OneNote. I always looked at Microsoft Notes as almost like a glorified notebook, right? Basically yeah. saying, I have a notebook, I have yeah. different tabs, I can put binders. And I'm like, what am I going to do with that? I can use Google Docs. And I ignored it. That's a great story too. And I want to jump into the next part of the conversation about how learning and innovation occur, right? So OneNote is an interesting concept because if you think about it, if Varun, my son, was yeah. a junior in high school, if he was out sick for a couple of days, the first thing he'll do is say, I'm going to ask my friends to lend me their notebook. So OneNote is just that, a yeah. online version of a notebook where you're storing their information. And now if he can take it to the next level and allow the instructor to build his own notes and share it with his classroom, yeah. and also allow the students to consume that and build their own version of notebook, that's a great story. What are some of the other innovations that you're looking for? For example, when you look at the education as it grows, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, game-based learning, stackable learning, micro-credentials. I would like to hear your thoughts more about where education is going and how technology plays a critical role in this innovation. Okay.
So to answer your question, Karan, I'm going to talk about celery. You know that green thing, no taste, no nutrition value, uh-huh. some fiber, maybe?
Sure, you have to dip it in this ranch.
Really, its only practical use is to move the dip from the bowl to your mouth.
Right, you know, that's right. It's a green spoon, you're right.
When you talk about all of these things to me, and this is why I say not everybody agrees, but I see that those are the tools to move what we're trying to do. That's to achieve an outcome. And,
right.
you know, G.K. Chesterton, who was a U.K. writer in the turn of the 20th century, one of the quotes I love from him says, it's not that they don't understand the solution. They have no idea what the problem is.
Or they created a solution that is convenient for them to implement. I feel like all yeah. colleges are just like, okay, we can't teach them everything. We'll just teach them what we can in the approach that
yeah.
makes sense for us and makes us money in the process.
They come to the solution or they go to a trade show and see something. And I said, you know, the number of times those of my colleagues who are listening to this, we call it, somebody goes to a trade show, finds this solution, buys it, on their, you know, on their grant money or whatever, throws it over the wall to IT because it can't work. And then suddenly you've got yet another system to deal with. So, I mean, I really have worked very hard to work with my senior colleagues to quit using that phrase and that solution that we've got. Can you tell me what your outcome is? Can you define the problem? And to the point where we've actually implemented, you know, a portfolio management model institutionally at our institution, which is had 2 years of running now, and we're actually gaining some good traction with it to actually define what those outcomes are supposed to be and allow us to prioritize which projects should be done. I refer back to the fact that because we were so siloed and so disconnected, in order to take advantage of those other tools, and these are like the tools out in my workshop that is just over there, those tools by themselves don't do anything much.
That's right.
You know, what's the plan? What am I building? You know, what tool do I need to accomplish that? So if we can do that slight shift in our way that we do things to begin to say, what is the outcome? Then what tool do I need? Like if you begin to say, like, it's great to go watch what they're doing in AI, AR, you know, you name it. And wouldn't that be cool? And we have an augmented reality lab at our school, and it's kind of cool to go in there and look at, but are people learning? Oh, you mean people have to learn when they come in here?
No. Right. And how do you measure learning?
So right? Isn't it cool? The cool factor or the wow factor, you know, the last place I was at, we, you know, it was a school that was the second in North America to implement a one-to-one laptop program. So this concept, if you give a child a laptop, are they going to learn any better? How do you know? What are you doing to measure that? You know, I was brought in there because we're spending a lot of money on technology. We want to make sure we're getting value out of it. What an interesting word to use in the secondary sector. What value are we getting out of this? Because we've particularly see that now with COVID for those of us institutions that rely heavily on people, non-domestic students, so to speak, people from other parts of our country, people from other parts of the world, to attend our schools, we're suddenly realizing, well, what if that went away overnight? Well, gee, it did. What is the concept of the value we're trying to put in place? As long as we're so siloed, we're not going to achieve the ability to drive that out. As long as we don't understand what is it we are really trying to do here. So when you come to that, having said that, though, let's just assume we get all that figured out and put together.
Yeah. What is a dream, right? And because
I gave it to you at the beginning in a little bit when I talked about, and this is my version of where we're probably going.
Sure.
Oh, a lot of people will be disagreeing with me, and that's okay. Things like micro-credentials with it, but without that recognized credentialing agency, you know, there's that missing piece. Is that a third party broker? Is that the Amazon of things? Getting a diploma from 1 year, that 4 year diploma from one particular institution or degree, it's going to be a challenge as more and more employers are realizing that they can cut free their HR systems and actually assess like their HR systems, which is a broken world in itself. The gig economy, you know, this, it's really important when people aren't working for necessarily one employer their whole life. They've got to be able to show, this is what I'm qualified to do. And that's got to be a system that is showing the potential employers, even gig employers, that, you know, so you've got the word of mouth and gig, but you've also got a way to be able to point them. And they can't keep going back to that same institution all the time, that they've got to have go to the broker's app on their behalf, getting that academic record anywhere. You know, that is kind of where much of this is going to go, but much of this new technology, so to speak, needs to be applied toward the student experience.
That's right.
Get them the information they need to adjust to their learning. Quiet little people, you know, if that's who you knock, you know, that's great. But for those of us who aren't quiet little people, lots of questions. How do you ensure that that experience is there? How do you measure it? So that is where the technology is going to come into play, and the ones that really get, you know, and have done the exercise. What's going to differentiate us? What is going to make students? You know, and right now they can be sitting in China, they can be sitting in India, Sri Lanka, South America, and decide that I want to be a rocket scientist, or I want to be a photographer. I want to be, you know, let's give the arts some credit here. How do I do that?
Sure.
You know, so our systems now, because as you mentioned, are so driven to make it easy for us to administrate them, you know. It's all about our ease and use, not about the student experience. So that is where these tools, the salary has to be applied. Let's really get together and say, how do we differentiate ourselves How do we get the tools in place to deliver that? Which tools do we need to make that happen? You know, recognizing too that it's going to be a life of partnerships moving forward. This is what we do really, really well. Like in the institution I work for, Sheridan College, if you've seen a Disney or a Pixar movie, you've seen our grads at work. We're really well known.
That's awesome.
Our animation program. But we also have school, and we also have, you know, and we have Allied Health, a number of things. We have, you know, but the school really has to sit there and be honest with itself and say, this is our differentiator. And what it's going to be, it's not, gee, what CRM system you use. It's not going to be that I have AI. It's how do you use that AI?
Yeah. And how does it apply to student experience and student learning?
And I'm an avid reader, Kiran. And one of the books I want to make sure I mentioned for your listeners is in the Tom Friedman wrote, he's best known for The World is Flat. Uh-huh. 2017, 2018, he wrote one called Thank You for Being Late.
Okay.
And it really is about dealing with the world of disruption that we are sending our students to. When our college got a new president, I bought her a copy of this book saying, here's the world we're sending our students. How do you think we need to be responsive in order to send successful students into this world? This is a book that it opens up with the rate of innovation in our world and our ability to adapt to that innovation. You know, electricity took a few years. The telephone took a few years. We've got more stuff coming at us now than we have capacity to adopt. So we're throwing, you know, like literally into the whirring blades of a blender, our graduates, and you're saying, are we preparing them for that world? And what do we need to do as an institution? It's scary, but, you know, this is when I'm absolutely convinced that this disruption is going to hit us because it has hit other sectors.
Absolutely.
So we are naive if we think that, no, it's just going to continue like this. COVID really differentiated a whole lot for some people. For those who weren't thinking along these lines before, they're the ones that are really hurt and bad when they're just trying to take their in-class experience and move it into an online format.
Yeah, I agree.
Because you're missing, that means you don't understand learning.
Yeah. Well, this is an amazing conversation. It feels like we can talk for hours together about your creative philosophy, your leadership in higher education, and leadership in technology. I would love for you to come back on the podcast anytime. And I really appreciated your leadership and direction and vision for higher education. Kevin, it's been an incredible honor, and it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Thank you for being on the Illuminate Higher Education Podcast.
Thank you. And I got another story to tell. So there we go.
All right. Thank you,
Kiran.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Illuminate Higher Education, sponsored by End-to-End Services and our Illuminate app. If something we said today resonated with you, please subscribe, rate, and download our podcast and share this episode with your network. You can learn more about Illuminate App at illuminateapp.com and continue the conversation with us there. If there are any topics you'd like us to discuss further, please email them to us at podcast@n2nservices.com. That's podcast@n2nservices.com. Thank you.